me an overview of your work.
Okay. I regard my work primarily on the academic side, in that I'm more of a, if there's a sort of scholar, practitioner, or social science a practitioner, I am heavily on the social science side. And the practice that I do is activities that have come up directly from my research work. And let me tell you what I mean by that. I started off as a someone trained in political science looking at conflicts in Africa. And then because I had expertise in certain areas of Africa, I was asked to go out on various projects, observing elections, working with the Carter Center to try to resolve what I to encourage some talks relating to political transition in Ethiopia and then later in Liberia. And so my practice work has come out of the out of a background of being a social scientist who studied conflict, if that makes sense. And so rather than somebody who goes out looking for areas to engage in practice, I am really somebody who looks for interesting research topics, and practice is often associated with that. So in other words, I will get involved in something such as the Ethiopia Dialogue, which I'll get into more later, that it was out of an interest in what role do diasporas play in creating protracted conflicts that I said, well, how can I get into that question? How can I begin to explore that question? Well, maybe if I helped organize a group that engaged in an extended dialogue with the Ethiopian diaspora, then I would learn more about it. And so my background is I deal mostly with civil wars, international conflicts, very, very violent conflicts, and with a predominant focus on Africa.
Right. I forgot to mention that I'm going to be looking at the machine from time to time.
Okay.
Don't let it distract you.
Is that just to make sure there's enough time or that we're getting at a good level?
Yeah, that we're getting levels, but especially that it's still going.
Otherwise, it's just a rhetorical interview, or it's just for our own edification.
Since I'm not taking notes. Okay, great. So, very violent conflicts, lots of African conflicts.
True.
One question that you and I have talked about a lot in class, and that I'd like to put to you now, is in a post-conflict area where there's been a lot of violence, is it more important to have stability or justice? And what's the trade-off, and then what's the implication for conflict resolution?
Yeah, that's it's a key question that I struggle with, because the answer is, as with many complicated issues, it's not all of one and none of the other.
Sure.
The way I have come to think about it is that it's a sequence and priority question. Both are necessary in the long run, but that to get justice in the context of continued instability is extremely difficult. So long as there are, armed factions and gunfire and displaced people, and people are afraid even to leave their homes or to join civil society organizations or to engage in normal social and economic behavior, then creating systems of justice is extremely difficult. And so first, in terms of both sequence and priority, has to be bringing order, ending the violence. And then the peace studies people and Gao Tong and so on tell us quite correctly that this can be a trap, that you can get stuck in negative peace or stability at the expense of justice in the long run. And so my feeling, the agenda of a post-conflict transition is that you start, but by no means end, you start with trying to build a stability, ending the violence, so that over the medium term, people are able to organize themselves in such a way that they can sustain long-term peace-building, justice, social harmony even, over a much, much longer period of time. But that what worries me, and many of my friends in both the conflict resolution field and the human rights field, see social justice as the first step, and then you can get stuck. So in other words, as we're doing this interview, Charles Taylor has just left Liberia for exile, and many people are quite appropriately saying he ought to go to the war crimes tribunal in Sierra Leone to account for his his involvement in that horrific civil war. But in the short term, the imperatives of ending the violence in Monrovia and allowing the people, not only of Liberia, but the people of Sierra Leone and Guinea and Cote d'Ivoire, the sort of constellations of conflict around Liberia, required putting justice on a longer term time horizon, and as a first step, getting Taylor out of Monrovia, the peacekeepers in Monrovia, and beginning a process. Again, my friends in Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International would tell me that that just builds a culture of impunity and you don't get conflict resolution. But I don't see how you get justice so long as 15-year-olds with Kalashnikovs control the streets of Monrovia. But you need to deal with that in its immediacy in the short run, but keeping your eye on the longer run.
So how then, in creating stability and order, do you ensure that there's not a return to sort of a latent power struggle where the strong man, like Pinochet, all of a sudden takes over Chile one day, and okay, you have order,
right.
You also have death squads and a horrible regime for the next 12 years.
Right.
And then people might argue, okay, you had a terrible regime for maybe 12 or 15 years, but then now there's democracy and everything's okay in Chile now. So is that what you have to go through, or is it worth going through a dictatorship like that, or are there better ways?
No, I certainly think there are better ways, and I wouldn't want to argue a certain linear causality that you must have authoritarian order in order to make the transition to democracy. In fact, in many parts of the world, democracy has come up in other ways. There's multiple models towards democracy. Gets me out of my, or gives me a chance to come up with my answer. one of the things that I like, an image that I think is useful in trying to understand these transitions is that, particularly immediately after a civil war, remember that my main area of focus is some of the most difficult, protracted, violent conflicts, Liberia, Mozambique, Cambodia, Tajikistan, Bosnia, where clearly you're not going to get to, a democracy as it would be recognized in the United States or elsewhere for many, many, many years. It's unrealistic to expect you go from state collapse to thriving democracy in a matter of years. It's going to be many, many years, perhaps even generational change. Are you getting that on the microphone?
Okay. Do you need to get that?
No, I'll let the machine get it, or my wife's actually upstairs. She'll pick it up
and
take a message. There's a question about, do you want to... you want to increase options. You want to provide the context so that new groups can emerge once there is stability, not to freeze people in the kind of polarized attitudes that they had during the war, or the kinds of organizations that developed during the war, meaning mostly warlords and militias and armed groups, but to provide stability that allows other groups to come up, civil society groups, non-military political parties, women's associations, human rights groups, peasants associations. And when you see that the structure is allowing that fluidity rather than locking in place the institutions, the structures of the conflict, but allowing peacetime institutions that can sustain long-term peace building are arising, then I think you're on the right track. In Liberia, after the 1997 elections, it was frozen that the only actors with power were military organizations, despite the fact that the war was over and there had been an election. Charles Taylor transformed his military organization into what he called a political party, but it really derived its power from the same kinds of behaviors and networks that sustained it during the war. And so how to make those institutions transform themselves is the challenge.
Mm-hmm. You've done some work in elections, monitoring,
yes,
and such, and elections are probably a clear indicator of moving towards some sort of social justice after order. But given that tension between people who want to rush to the social justice and the need for order, can you get to elections too early? Is there a risk in going straight to elections?
Yeah, there's certainly a risk in moving to elections too quickly, but I would also argue that there's a trap in waiting too long. Again, and so it's one of these very difficult kind of... there is a tension between two different dynamics and trying to find the balance point in between these two different directions. To go too early means that you have elections while the people are still frightened, still dominated by the sort of legacies of fear and violence of the war. And people who are frightened will also often vote for the person who promises them protection, who's often a military person. So in other words, yeah, strongman. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all if you are a Bosnian Muslim who's been purged or ethnically cleansed out of his or her village, and you have a chance to vote, you're going to vote for the biggest, strongest Bosnian Muslim that you can find, who credibly promises no one will ever chase you out of your home again. Mm-hmm. And I have the arms and I have the military skills to do that, rather than somebody who says, you know, I'm going to make peace, or I'm going to establish your relationships with our former adversaries. But to wait too long, often means that some structure has to govern the country. It can't just float, and so groups will come in and install themselves in the interim and put themselves into key positions of power and strengthen themselves during the transition, and without any legitimacy, without anybody telling them that that is okay. So, for example, in Afghanistan, there's an awful lot of these militia leaders who are now in the interim establishing themselves in little fiefdoms. They haven't had to face elections. No one's there to say, no, you're not allowed actually to control this area because I won the election. They just do it. And so again, the most powerful, often not people driving from military power or power from things like diamond running in West Africa or drug running out of Afghanistan or Colombia or places like that, put themselves into position of power. So you don't want to wait so long that these types of institutions and leaders create facts on the ground, embed themselves in the society in ways that makes it more difficult to have this kind of open-ended transition. Mm. And so it varies. And there's another way of looking at it. A lot of people say that, let me use the Bosnia case as an example, that elections in Bosnia were too fast, so therefore the warlords, the military people, won the elections. I would argue that the problem was not that the elections happened too fast, it's that the peace agreement by its very nature was a peace agreement that was a peace among ultranationalists and therefore a peace designed to protect the interests of ultranationalists on all sides. And don't blame the election for that. Mm. It goes much beyond the election. The election was the event that allowed us to see most clearly that this was a system that was doing nothing. This was a peace process that was doing nothing to break the hold of hyper-nationalists over their respective communities. And this is not just the Serbians. It was true of the Bosniaks and the Croatians as well. Mm. And so the election... elections are kind of snapshots of political power at a time. And they don't change that power. And so the power of the distribution of power, the term I use in some of my writings, is the topography of power. If you imagine power as almost a 3D map, if you looked at Bosnia in 1996 when the elections took place, you would have seen three high mountains. One was led by, you know, Serbian nationalists, another by Croatian nationalists, and a third by Bosnian Muslim nationalists. Mm. And the election showed three parties winning in their respective communities. And it wasn't that the elections created that outcome. The elections reflected an outcome that this three-part division of power was a result of the war and had not been changed by the peace process. And the election simply reflected that.
So in a sense, the peace process crystallized the legitimacy of the power.
That's a very good
three different entities.
It's a very good way to put it, because it's that an election provides some sort of legitimacy, but also kind of locks in place a certain distribution of power. Mm-hmm. And so if you can have a peace process, that keeps that power more amorphous, changing, flexible, fluid, rather than locking in place the power of a certain number of groups. And so the topography in Bosnia Herzegovina had three powerful parties, each in their respective ethnic zones. In Liberia, there was one peak, and that was Charles Taylor's National Patriotic Party. In Mozambique, there were two peaks. It was fairly evenly balanced between the government and the insurgency. In Cambodia, it was, you know, three. So it varies. Mm-hmm. But in a post-conflict context, an election is very likely to crystallize the power of the groups that became powerful as a result of the war. And that's the worry, is that you're going to increase the power of the military leaders and organizations who may call themselves political parties, but in fact are really derive their power, not because they've mobilized a constituency with... the constituencies they mobilize are largely mobilized through the manipulation of fear. In other words, vote for me because the other guy is going to come and steal your land if I don't stop him, or vote for me or else we will go back to war. And so those elections are really about war and peace, not about democratic empowerment or the choice of policies or any number of other things that elections might be about. But don't worry too much about the first election, because that's often an election about order, about peace. Mm-hmm. Worry about, is this first election provide a beginning that then allows you in the second, third, fourth, fifth election to have a more structure that can sustain peace building.
So creating a culture of democracy just by having an election, in a sense?
Well, and the institutions of democracy. In other words, political parties and rule of law and independent media and civil society that often mobilizes and organizes around elections.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you say don't worry about the first election, because when you said it would be good to have a peace process that makes a more amorphous power base, then it made me think of our initial conversation about stability and how it may have crystallized those hyper-nationalists in Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia, but yet that's fairly stable, right, to have three identifiable points of power like that.
Yeah, and I probably shouldn't have said don't worry about the first election, but don't make your assessment about the entire process about just the first election, because a first election may be... I think it's often the case that the first election is about is frightened people still very much mindful of the war voting for parties who promise to protect them. Mm. And they're often nationalist and often military-based. But second and third and fourth elections, if there is stability, are often about jobs and schools and who offers the most, the promise, how to vote those corrupt people out of power. And so in Croatia, for example, this is less true in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The nationalists have held on to power to date, you know, 6 years, quite a while. In Croatia proper, the old Tudjman people were regarded as corrupt, and once there was no longer a war where they could pose as the protectors of the Croatian nation, they were perceived as corrupt, people who were pocketing all the money. And the voters said, I don't need them to protect me, and they certainly haven't given me a job, so let me try another party, let me try some other alliance. So subsequent elections can be different from the early elections. This is in some ways an argument that says, you know, in the long run things will get better, but of course people live and die and are imprisoned and so on in the short run. Mm-hmm. And so how long must you wait? And it's often quite easy for someone from the outside to say, oh, just give it a generation and things will get better. But for people on the ground or, you know, living and struggling and dying in very much in the short term, very much in the immediate term.
Can you vote corruption out of office, or is it an institutional thing?
You can. There's often movements to sort of vote the bums out, where voters become fed up with the individuals in office, or even the political party in office. The problem is the people who are voted in often fall prey to the same incentives and the same the same structures.
Or even cronies to the people who got voted out, right? Like lower in the same party or something like that.
Or they very, very quickly, it becomes sort of a cycle of different people getting their time at the trough. At least that's what they talk about it in terms of in African democracies. So in Zambia, for example, when there was an election and a new leader came in, he ended up sort of replicating the patterns of the guy he had campaigned against as corrupt and ineffective because the structures are very, very powerful that lead people in those directions. And it's not just that all politicians are venal and only interested in their own self-aggrandizement, but these are very powerful institutions and structural constraints. And so I do think it is possible through the ballot box to change the government slowly over time. Again, these things don't happen all at once, but over time, different leaders respond to the political incentives and move the country into a different direction.
Yeah. This image of a cycle in my mind is growing where I've heard people say that there are no old ex-leaders in Africa because they either stay in office until they get killed or they leave, they get assassinated or there's a problem and which inhibits the transfer of power. They don't want to give up power because as soon as they do, they're going to be killed or someone's going to take them down with them.
Right.
And so then I think of the things like the International Court of Justice and things like that. And what incentive do I have as a leader, maybe even if I was at least nominally democratically elected in my country, what incentive do I have to turn over power if I know I'm going to go to the ICJ or if I'm going to go, if I'm going to be knocked off somewhere or something like that?
Yeah.
How do you deal with, dealing or punishing people who have done wrong versus pushing them, in a sense, to stay in office longer than necessary?
Right.
I mean, you see what I'm saying here, this balance?
No, it's another of the conundrums or of the paradoxes that you don't want to set the bar in such a way that your choices either steal the election or go to jail.
Yeah.
If you give a powerful person that choice, you will have a lot of stolen elections or a lot of elections that are overturned through military coup or what have you, a number of procedures. Fortunately, in Africa, in the last decade, there are at least beginning to get examples of retired African leaders. Nelson Mandela, of course, is the most prominent among them, but Jerry Rawlings in Ghana is an ex-president who is around to tell the tale. And Benin in West Africa, Karaku, the leader, was both thrown out of office and then 4 or was it 8 years later, brought back in, elected again, sort of in an astonishing way. But there are people who say for Jerry Rawlings, the president in Ghana, that they want him to account for his deeds, particularly in the early days. He came to power through military coup and then moved to elections. And there were some trials in which his political opponents were executed and so on. But that's a very, very difficult trade-off. People say that one of the reasons why George Washington is such a revered figure in the United States is not so much how he governed, but that he stepped down after 2 terms.
Right. Therefore, nobody remembers what he did.
Right. I mean, but the most important thing he did, one might say 200 and some odd years, 230 years after the fact, one of the most important things that he did was not run again and to say that there is life after politics, and so on. In Africa and in other parts of the developing world, so much power gets concentrated at the head of state level. In other words, you don't have it is through government position that you gain wealth and gain power and privilege and so on, that it becomes an all-or-nothing game. You either win the elections or you're a nobody. Where in the United States, you can lose an election and go off and run your business or become a TV, celebrity, do a talk show. I mean, Al Gore, Bill Clinton, these are Jimmy Carter, Jerry Ford. These are all, people of some wealth and prestige and power in society, even though they're after formal political office. And that is something that takes a long time to develop. And it's just as I could probably name a handful of examples in Africa where that has happened. Mm-hmm. But it has happened. Daniel Arap Moi in Kenya stepped down. I never thought that would happen, but yet it did. He accepted that life after power was better than holding on to power at all, at all costs.
Hmm. So there's hope.
There is indeed.
Okay.
Things are moving.
Good. Well, let's talk about diaspora then.
Okay.
And how they affect either the maintenance or the resolution of conflict in their domestic settings.
Yeah. I have been trying to track out some of these dynamics of how diasporas relate to their conflicts back home. It became not just apparent to me, other people have seen this as well, that there is at least a set of protracted civil wars where diaspora groups abroad are very powerful forces in keeping the conflict protracted, making compromise and settlement more difficult. Cases that I've been trying to understand better are things like in Sri Lanka, the Tamil diaspora in Northern Europe is a very powerful force that is reinforcing the hardliners, the people who don't want to compromise, providing resources, helping to frame the conflict in ways that you cannot compromise. It's an all-or-nothing struggle. It's also true of some of the Irish in the United States, for example, that the hardline don't compromise wing of the IRA was supported by Irish in New York and Boston, more so than by Irish in Northern Ireland, in other words. And this is true with Ethiopians, this is true with Armenians, with Kurds, there's a number of cases that this is true. And so it occurs to me that one of the ways to try to intervene or to play a constructive role in these conflicts is to work with the diasporas and to see if there are ways to help the diaspora engage in processes that lead them to be more of a force for constructive conflict resolution rather than stalemate and so on. I mean, diasporas often are reluctant to compromise or to accept a settlement because, on the one hand, the cost of the conflict is less for them. I mean, they're sitting in townhouses in Fairfax, Virginia, and so to say everything to the war front is a different type of statement than for somebody in the war zone to say everything to the war front when their children or they themselves are at risk. And holding on to the conflict, holding on to the cause, and it's often an important cause, and it's even a cause worth mobilizing for, a cause of social justice or liberation. But holding on to the cause is extremely valuable because it gives them an identity. I'm not just one of 250 million Americans. I am a Romo, an Ethiopian, one of the ethnic groups within Ethiopia, or I am a Kurd, or I am an Armenian, and part of my identity is, as an Armenian American, is mobilizing and working for social justice for Armenians. And that gives me it's a very powerful and very I get great benefit from working on behalf of that cause. And being in North America or Europe or Australia or any number of other places means that the diaspora groups often have relatively more resources. You know, as many of the refugees, of course, are working, or people in the diaspora are working at low-end jobs from a North American point of view, but if you're sending $100 a month home, that's a huge amount of money for village life in much of the world. And so you have tremendous prestige and also power that comes from those resources. Often many of the media sources are run from abroad, partly because you can't run a newspaper in many of these war zones, or run a website, or create videotapes, or do radio shows. But you can in New York, and London, and Hamburg, and Lisbon, and elsewhere abroad. And so, let me use the Ethiopian example, which is one of the ones that I know best, is that Ethiopian politics, the debates, the way that the conflict is framed, is largely framed by Ethiopians here in Washington, D.C., and in Western Europe, particularly in Germany. because they have the newspapers, the websites, the radio shows. Within Ethiopia, it's first of all very difficult to run some of these media operations. It costs money. Newspapers are regularly closed down in Ethiopia. And so a lot of the debate about what is acceptable and what is unacceptable from a political point of view are set or established by people in the diaspora and then filtered back home. You see this in that Ethiopian politicians, including opposition politicians, will regularly come to the United States to have town meetings to address people in the diaspora, to raise money, to try to influence the debate, to try to position themselves as the leader of the opposition. Mm. They come here to the United States because part of what they want to do is they want to do an interview, they want to talk to people here, knowing that that'll get picked up by the media here, which would then be read by people back in Ethiopia, and in that way provide them with a certain position. But it's tricky because the groups here are often non-compromising, all-or-nothing groups. And so it forces the politicians from Ethiopia to appeal to a certain political set of ideas that are often do not facilitate conflict resolution. So at ICAR with my colleague Chris Mitchell and Tamara Pearson Destray, we helped organize what we called the Extended Ethiopian Dialogue, where we worked with groups of Ethiopians in the Washington diaspora to try to get people from different perspectives together to begin to understand each other better, to be able to recognize that to complicate their perceptions often of the conflict back home, but really to see if we could develop a process that would allow them to relate to the conflict back home in new ways, in ways that we hoped would be more constructive.
Yeah. Talk for just a second about how polarized the community was within Washington.
Yeah. Within Washington, these are mostly, within a community, many of whom have been in the United States for many, many years, some of them decades, they were extremely polarized in that, say, the Oromos, which is the largest single ethnic group within Ethiopia, the Oromo groups would very rarely talk with other Ethiopian groups, particularly Amhara groups, the old elite, the old governing group. And so within the diaspora in Washington, there were different subsets who would go to different restaurants, belong to different churches often, different community associations. And so the Oromo Community Association would have nothing to do with the Ethiopian Community Association because many Oromos do not regard themselves as Ethiopians. They see Ethiopia as an empire that they were coerced into. Not all Oromos think that, but there is a segment of the community that feels that very, very strongly. Mm-hmm. And so part of our process was to get Oromos and Amharas and others into a room together to talk with one another about how they perceive themselves, the community, the conflict back home, the issues of history, identity, language, you know, all of these core things that we know from conflict analysis are so deeply embedded in protracted conflicts, and to begin to both understand each other better and to generate new ways of understanding the conflict. And in part, many of the Ethiopians in our group told us that in earlier community meetings, the meetings often ended up being very, very partisan and political, and some political organization or leader of a political organization would stand up and say, this is the truth, stand with me or you are my enemy. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult to get out of that. The meetings would end in shouting matches or with the sort of leaders of political factions seizing the agenda. By conducting an extended dialogue with not with political leaders, but with kind of mid-level community leaders, community leaders, not political leaders. We were able to encourage people to talk and listen to each other in new ways, I think. I was very proud of that work, actually. and in that way to complicate their understandings and to begin to say, well, I still don't agree with that guy, but I at least now begin to understand he's not saying that just because he's out to destroy me or my people, or he's not saying that because he has ill intent. It's because of his understanding of the history of his people, for example.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a very direct link between politics in Ethiopia and the very group that you were facilitating in Washington. Can you tell that story and be general enough about it that doing this compromise? Where there was some situation where a leader was coming and one of the members of the group who was very close to that leader... Yeah. Told them that it was okay to listen to this side or something. I don't remember the details.
I'm not sure that's I can say in general that the people we said, as with many conflict resolution processes, with the problem solving workshops and other types of processes, selecting the group is often critical, extremely difficult. Mm. One of the things that we did in our Ethiopia dialogue was to look for people who, we were not seeking representatives of the X group, whether it was an ethnic identity or political identity and so on. We wanted people who were generally well informed of represented voices of the community. Many of them had links. This is a characteristic of diaspora groups in general, that they were very closely linked with political figures and political organizations back home, and that was good. That was fine, and so that they would bring in ideas from some of the political organizations, and they would be able to, we presumed, feed back into the political debates some of the learning that was taking place within the dialogue group.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, not be simply an exercise of the 12 people in the room, but something that would feed into larger political dynamics. As is often the case with conflict resolution processes, measuring that, seeing that, evaluating that is extremely difficult, except in the most subjective of ways. But we at least... we're hoping and have some reason to think that some of the ideas out of the dialogue fed into larger debates and discussions.
Yeah, it's interesting because the more I hear about systems theory, mm-hmm. and people talk about complex adaptive systems and double loop learning, things like that,
mm-hmm.
This is almost, and of course secondary effects of systems, right?
Yes.
I feel like the diaspora is working at a secondary level to the conflict, but it feeds very much directly into the primary level, yeah. of the conflict.
Well, and part of the why I think that on the practice side, for practitioners and people who are engaged in different conflict resolution interventions, working with diasporas is often a very rich set of opportunities. Not because they are the primary driving force behind the conflict, but because, first of all, they're accessible. You mm-hmm. don't need to go off to the bush. They're often right in your backyard. I mean, they're in the major cities. It seemed ridiculous to me being in Fairfax, Virginia, and trying to imagine how could we do conflict resolution in, you know, Azerbaijan, when I kept saying, there's people who are in conflict, I mean, international conflicts, Ethiopians, yeah. just down yeah. the street. And why don't we start... you know, working in our own backyard at low cost, and we don't have to have a huge proposal, it doesn't take a big budget, and begin that way. And that will get you to understand the conflict, to have access to the communities, to build up trust, to build up, people begin to understand who you as a facilitator, who ICAR is, and in that way expand the circles. I have no doubt that there is great potential working with diaspora groups. We started with the Ethiopians partly because it was a community that I knew, and partly because it is an extremely high concentration of Ethiopians in the Washington area. Anybody in Washington who goes to 18th Street and looks for a decent meal will know that there's a lot of Ethiopians in Washington.
Oh, anyone's ever taken a cab?
Anybody's taken a cab or parked a car or checked into a hotel, any yeah. number of other places yeah. will know that there's a tremendous number of Ethiopians. Well, and this is part of the nature of the diaspora communities. Ethiopians, Eritreans, yeah. Oromos, people who often identify themselves within the communities very differently than how those on the outside look upon them.
Right.
Somalis. But in other places it might be with Tamils or Kurds or any number of other groups. If we were in Los Angeles, I might be working with Armenians or something like that. Mm-hmm. If I was in New York City, maybe I'd want to work with the Irish, and it would depend on where I was.
About the Irish. Has there ever been an Irish dialogue?
Not to my knowledge.
Outside of Ireland?
No, not to my knowledge, and I think that's a problem. Because
right.
I think part of the, not the only dynamic, but part of the dynamic of the conflict in Ireland is that groups in the diaspora don't want to give up the conflict.
Yeah.
That they don't want Ireland to be a normal place with normal people, you know, normal political life. It is important to them, for their identity as Irish-American nationalists, to have this cause, not to surrender this cause. And you need 100%. If you are, you know, you're not willing to say, well, we'll take 80% of our agenda and be extremely pleased. That's very, very difficult when you're in exile. You need it all. And so that feeds into the most hardline elements who don't want to settle. And when furthermore, when some of these groups, in order to show their loyalty to their cause, are collecting money and guns and shipping them to the conflict, it creates protracted dynamics. And so to deal with the conflict on the ground, as many people have been done for many, many years, but there was an additional need to work with the diaspora.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Cuban American ones is another case.
Yeah,
I don't know the conflict as well, but people tell me that one of the dynamics that makes settlement of some of the Israeli Palestinian issues so difficult are Jewish American groups here in the United States who don't want to surrender one inch of territory because they regard it as, you know. It is so salient to their identity. It is so important to who they are. That the dealing with these aspects, I think, opens up alternatives and opportunities for people back home in the conflict.
Mm-hmm. Even though, I mean, I'm sure there's tons of dialogues between Israelis and Palestinians every day, or at least around here, panels anyway.
Sure.
Between people.
One of the things, actually, what we've done with the Ethiopia Dialogue is we've written up a very large report.
Oh, you did?
Well, you were part of it when we were doing some of the month-by-month reports.
Yeah.
And then we tried to do a synthesis report. We did write a synthesis report. What we have now is about a 20-page report that is written by ICAR and is in the ICAR voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's reflecting from conflict resolution practitioners on the process. But we were trying to capture two things. This report has not been released, and we still have to have a couple more meetings with the group to get them to see if they're comfortable doing that. But they're much closer now than they were. They seem to be anxious after all of these meetings that they want some learning to come out of it. They don't want it all just to kind of dissipate. Learning both in terms of learning about the learning that went on the sort of the content of the conflict about how different perspectives on the Ethiopian conflict, but then also learning about the dialogue process itself and how it's a useful process for dealing with conflicts.
Yeah.
And we hope to be able to continue to work. Again, this is now to move from the kind of the academic, the practitioner to the scholar, to write up from a more academic point of view, what did we learn from this process in terms of from a conflict analysis point of view? What do we now understand better about how identity and language and history and so on link up to the conflict? And what do we now understand better about how dialogue processes within the diaspora can work to help open up new options, open up greater opportunities, provide more space for constructive conflict resolution.
Are they still meeting?
No. There will be a meeting relating to this report,
but
we have not met since February.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was a long time.